This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Natural gas prices had quite a day today, up almost 5% at the close in New York. No surprise, really, given that we're about to learn we don't have as much of it as we thought we did. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 5th of April today. The Energy Department comes out with a report every month saying how much natural gas we produce, how much we have in stockpiles, how much we're using, all that stuff. Does the same thing for oil, too. And they're used for a whole bunch of different things, making capital investments, predicting future prices, basically letting exploration companies figure out if it makes sense to keep on drilling. Pretty tool to have, actually, until it's not. The Energy Department said today it's going to change the way it puts that natural gas report together because it's been overestimating our supplies. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
Every month, the government takes a survey of natural gas companies and uses that data to guess how much we're producing. Chris Jarvis is an energy consultant. He says he's long suspected the reports weren't all that accurate.
To be quite frank, you know, every time the data was released, you kind of had to take it with a grain of salt.
He says over the last couple of years, improved drilling techniques have opened up new regions. A lot of gas is now coming from small drillers in places like North Texas instead of from big ones in the Gulf of Mexico.
There's a lot of smaller players in the market. It's not your typical offshore, you know, big player drillers.
By only talking to those big offshore players, the government's not getting the full picture anymore. So it's been telling us we're producing a lot more than we actually are. One analyst said the government data was off by more than 10%. Producers say that's made for artificially low prices. Jarvis says prices may go up initially after the government releases the revised report, but longer term, he thinks the new reporting will make for a less volatile market. Gus Fauché is an economist with Moody'sEconomy.com. He says depending how you use natural gas, this could be important to you.
In general, the pass-through from prices at the well goes through pretty quickly to consumers for things like heating. In terms of electricity, the pass-through tends to be more delayed.
The government will issue the revised January and February reports at the end of April. At the end of the year, it plans to put out reports that recalculate production for all of last year. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Two of the biggest names in the beverage industry are coming together for more than just a drink. Pepsi and Anheuser-Busch InBev say they're going to expand a joint purchasing deal that they announced back in October. Now they are going to be coordinating advertising buys as well. Together, the two companies spend more than $1 billion a year on television, radio, and print and billboard ads. And with that new partnership, they're hoping to leverage that joint power and negotiate some lower ad rates. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
Haggling has long been part of the culture when it comes to buying advertising time or space, but collective bargaining?
Companies are looking for every possible means to save dollars, and I think this is potentially one of those ways.
Gary Hemphill is the managing director of a research and consulting firm called Beverage Marketing Corporation. He says he can't remember another example of two companies teaming up for better ad rates, but
if this proves to be successful, it could have a somewhat of a snowball effect with other marketers attempting to do kind of the same thing and recoup savings.
Savings that could really add up, according to George Belch, a marketing professor at San Diego State University.
You have two firms spending over $1 billion, even if they get concessions of 10%. Yeah, that's pretty significant.
Especially during highly watched events like the Super Bowl, when advertising costs $5 million a minute. But it's those non-Super Bowl shows with their dwindling audiences that are giving advertisers the upper hand. Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He says the only way for media companies to fight back is to produce content that's irresistible to Madison Avenue.
Clearly, a lot of it's going to drive by having properties that are must-buy, because then you've got some leverage against these advertisers who have huge budgets.
And now a new strategy to make those huge budgets go even further. One Calkins says is likely to become more common if it works. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Timothy Geithner made a decision over the weekend that could have some far-reaching consequences. Treasury Secretary said he's going to wait a while before he announces whether or not he thinks China is officially manipulating its currency. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
China's critics say it's manipulating its currency to make Chinese exports cheaper. The White House was due to issue a currency report on April 15th, but then China's president agreed to attend a security summit April 12th. The Obama administration needs China's help to limit nuclear proliferation.
So they don't want to antagonize and alienate China. So they'd rather make some kind of an arrangement.
That's Clyde Prestowitz. He heads the Economic Strategy Institute. He thinks the U.S.-China arrangement could go like this. The two countries keep talking for 3 months. Then China announces it'll allow its currency, the yuan, to inch up in value.
So it wouldn't look like they're knuckling under through the White House.
And the White House can say it's boosting U.S. exports. Nicholas Lardy is at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says a rise in the yuan would help U.S. exporters of things like machinery and steel pipes.
If the prices of Chinese goods go up 5% and the price of U.S. goods goes down 5%, then for some products, that will make a difference.
And it's a win for China, too. John Frisby is president of the U.S.-China Business Council. He says right now, China has to use lots of yuan to buy commodities like oil, which are priced in dollars.
If their currency strengthened, they'd pay less in their own currency for those products, and that would help their inflation.
And tame inflation would help China avoid social unrest, one of Beijing's biggest fears about letting its currency rise. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We said at the end of last week that today could be pretty interesting in the markets after a Good Friday jobs report that we had. Stocks didn't trade on the holiday Friday, but they sure did today. Higher. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've been paying attention in the produce aisle of late, you might have been able to snag a great deal on strawberries. They're selling for less than a dollar a box here in Los Angeles. Cold weather has pushed Florida's strawberry harvest back into California's growing season, which means a flood of extra berries on the market and a huge headache for farmers down in Florida. Gary Wisniewski is a strawberry grower in Plant City, Florida. Mr. Wisniewski, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you.
How's the strawberry season treating you so far?
It hasn't been one of our better seasons in a situation where most growers are probably going to lose money this year.
So now what do you do when you have all these extra strawberries out there?
We have a process line, so we fortunately are able to utilize our surplus by putting it into frozen product. Many other growers didn't have that same opportunity, unfortunately. And typically in mid-February, growers will plant in the same bed spring crop like melons, eggplant, tomatoes, or cucumbers. But by late March, the two crops begin to compete for room, and at that point, the grower would just come in and twist off the strawberry plants to give the spring crop room to grow. This year, the extended cold slowed the strawberry harvest down.
In other words, you guys are sliding because of the weather, and California's coming in a bit earlier, right?
Yes, correct, and we've just kind of created the perfect storm here.
That brings up another point of getting these plants to market and these berries to market. It can't be worth your while when your price that you're getting is so far down.
Yes, actually, prices have not been that much lower, if at all, this year. The difference is that the crop has just come in much later, so the volume is coming in on a lower late market. But the cost to harvest and pack a flat of strawberries is about $5. So if you're getting less than $5, you're losing money on each flat that you pick.
I understand you have another way to get your berries off the plants there. You sort of opened up the field for a pick your own?
Yeah, we did that. We were just sitting around lunch and we were talking about the surplus of berries. We said, well, why don't we just open up our field one day and let the food banks come in and glean the field? And the response we got was phenomenal. We estimated that over 5,000 people showed up that day.
How many berries you figure 5,000 non-professional pickers can pick?
Yeah, 5,000 non-professionals. They must have picked about 8,000 flats, we assume. We couldn't even pick it on our normal three-day cycle after that. They had picked everything down to almost green berries, so we had to give them an extra day before we went back in that field.
Gary Wisniewski, he owns Wish Farms in Plant City, Florida. They've been growing strawberries down there since 1922. Mr. Wisniewski, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Kai. I appreciate it.
Online shoppers in Russia have had a little bit more than a week now to get used to the latest Western import. eBay has set up shop in one of the last great untapped e-commerce markets. Russia has about 142 million people. Online sales there are just $5 billion a year. And there are some early signs eBay is going to be a hit once it gets over the rough spots. From Moscow, Peter Van Dyke reports.
The Russian online market offers huge growth potential, but Russia's postal service is unreliable and the public is suspicious of paying online because hacking and identity theft are widespread. Even so, analysts say eBay is wise to set up shop here.
For international players like eBay, it's important to have an early mover advantage.
David Ferguson is the media analyst for Renaissance Capital Investment Bank in Moscow.
The Russian internet market as a whole has typically favoured domestic or incumbent local companies. And the risk for eBay is if you don't go to the market quickly, a local operator locks in the market. And in the medium term, it can then be very, very difficult to challenge their dominant market position.
With 200,000 visitors a day, the current market leader in online auction sales is Molotok.ru. Molotok is Russian for hammer. Pavel Tokarov is the company's chief operational officer. He says he welcomes eBay.
We will have another strong player here, and the market is developing, and the entrance of eBay shows that the market is in a way ready for big companies.
The relatively few Russians who do shop online also welcome eBay, but many say the new site won't provide what they need.
Just translating the interface isn't enough. eBay will have to offer the same level of service they give to buyers and sellers in the West.
Mikhail Uspensky is a project manager at a Russian IT firm. He has bought more than 100 items on eBay since 2001, mainly from the US, Britain, and Hong Kong. He pays using PayPal with his Russian credit card. But the postal problems mean he's not buying anything right now.
Like many people in Russia, I've stopped buying for the moment. Sometimes purchases are held up for more than 3 months. I just received something I paid for at the start of December last year.
The Russian Post Office blames the delays on holdups with parcels at the border, caused in part by the creation of a customs union with Belarus and Kazakhstan at the start of the year. eBay can't do much about that, but it has a level of brand recognition that gives it a unique opportunity to take advantage of Russia's developing consumer culture, which Molotok's Tokarov says means more and more Russians have unwanted goods worth selling.
In the US, in Europe, I think people have enough items, enough goods, enough, I don't know, inventory they do not need. In Russia, it's not the way because the situation here is different for like tens of years, dozens of years. So now the situation is changing and people start to sell the things they do not need.
That means the market is bound to grow and eBay may soon be in a position, alongside Molotok and several smaller rivals, to reap the rewards. For Marketplace, I'm Peter Van Dyke in Moscow.
Coming up, a confessional in the midst of cardio.
Personal trainers are a cross between a therapist and a bartender. I can't give out drugs and I don't serve alcohol, but I hear lots of people's stuff.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials tacked on 46 points today, about 0.4%, closed at 10,973, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ gained 26 points, more than 1%, ended at 2429. The S&P 500 picked up 9 points, about 0.75%, finished at 1187. Oil and gas prices hit an 18-month high today, as we mentioned. Music to the ears of big oil. Shares of Chevron pumped up 1.25% today. ExxonMobil gushed up 0.8%. Some new data showed more people signed contracts in February to buy existing homes than they did in January. So can anybody say new countertops? Shares of home improvement chain Lowe's moved up 1.33% today. Rival Home Depot closed up more than 0.8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, Congress remains on recess. The action resumes next week. The Urban Institute hosts a forum, Double Trouble, Metro Areas Racked by Housing and Job Shocks. And it's the anniversary of the first Tony Awards, held on Easter Sunday, April 6, 1947, at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 30,000 people at the South Lawn of the White House today for the annual Easter egg roll. The business world rolled out some eggs of its own this morning as well, the kind you eat over easy, maybe not the hard-boiled ones push around in the grass at the White House. Subway Restaurants has joined the battle over the morning meal. It's introduced a breakfast menu. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more on the home of the $5 footlong stepping up its morning game.
The breakfast crowd is getting kind of crowded.
The new BK Breakfast Muffin Sandwich for a buck.
It's the one and only Sausage McMuffin.
Subway now has breakfast!
Americans spent more than $55 billion on Egg McMuffins, hash browns, and lattes last year. Restaurants rolled out hundreds of new breakfast items. Why the early morning rush? It's the only part of the fast food business that's growing, says Harry Balzer with consumer research firm NPD Group.
It's one bright spot in the restaurant industry, and that's why I think you're seeing a lot of people running to that space.
Subway's muffin melts will go up against new offerings from heavyweights like Burger King and McDonald's, which is doing a dollar breakfast menu and experimenting with new foods like oatmeal. The recession took a bite out of fast food breakfasts last year, but now that the economy is recovering, restaurants want to be ready, says industry consultant Gary Steibel.
Restaurants that offer a compelling value proposition for Americans returning to work or returning to spending are going to be way ahead of the curve as we come out of this recession.
Steibel says breakfast is cheap to make and doesn't eat into other business. People who eat breakfast are just as likely to eat lunch as people who don't. Subway noticed that trend when it was test marketing breakfast. Jeff Larson is VP of marketing at Subway.
We found that a healthy breakfast business has very positive impacts on our lunch business.
Other big chains are watching. Everyone from Taco Bell to Quiznos is scrambling to get on the breakfast bandwagon. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
With just 10 days to go until taxes are due, we get this tidbit from Bankrate. Refunds.com. Their research shows only 7% of Americans plan to blow their refunds on something fun. The rest of us are going to do some distinctly non-fun but probably prudent things like paying down our debts and covering food and utility bills, even saving and investing, too. But whatever your plans are, the government obviously has an interest in making sure we all file accurately and on time. Changing our tax-paying behavior is a natural topic for Duke University's Dan Ariely. Dan, it's good to have you back.
My pleasure.
I am proud to tell you that I basically am net zero on my taxes. Had a little refund coming, owed a little bit to the feds, so we're all set in my house.
That's a very nice feeling.
Yes.
I actually had a really miserable weekend because I tried to find out all the receipts. I tried to log into my bank and find out all the transactions I did for the last year. It was really miserable. And actually, I thought about it. You know, when I first filled the 10 Easy form when I was a grad student, I thought, what a wonderful day to, as an exercise of citizenship, to reflect about your role in society, what you're taking, what you're giving, and so on. But once I moved away from the 1040 Easy form, it became less of an exercise of citizenship and more, I'm just annoyed. I'm just pissed off with all these rules and regulations and the lack of clarity in how to fill everything.
Well, all right. So enlighten us. What's your plan?
So I think, first of all, the idea of simplifying taxes is really important from that perspective. But the second thing is that I think we should actually let people reflect on what their taxes are doing. So imagine how we could encourage that. What we could be doing is to get people to vote on how a small part of their taxes will be distributed. Maybe 5%, maybe 3%, where I would give you a list of all the public service that the government is responsible for, and you decide how to allocate your money. Now, it's not so much just for the allocation decision, but for the reflection. Thinking about what do we do in society, what our taxes go for. You might be incredibly upset with the government, you might be incredibly pleased, but the important thing is to get this exercise of thinking where our taxes go.
What about the people who either underpay or don't pay their taxes, right? I mean, the folks who cheat, do they still get to vote?
Well, the reality is that if you didn't let people who cheat on their taxes vote, nobody would be there to vote. I mean, just look at the Obama administration. When the Obama administration came to power, we discovered that lots of people on that administration underreported their taxes.
The Secretary of the Treasury and a couple of others, yeah.
For example. So actually, cheating on taxes is something that is incredibly general. And I think, again, it has to do with the complexity of the tax code. You go to dinner with your aunt and she asked you how work was going and you told her about some interview and she gave you some good idea. You know, what can you deduct now? The reality is the tax code is so confusing and there's so many gray zones that I think lots of people are taking these gray zones and stretching them slightly more in a selfishly convenient way.
You would absolutely expect that, though, right? As a guy who studies behavioral economics, you would expect people to take advantage of those gray zones.
That's right. So what we generally find is that people want to optimize two goals. We want to think of ourselves as good, honorable people, and we want to benefit from cheating. And under normal circumstances, you would say you can't get both of those. You're either honest or you benefit from cheating. But it turns out that as long as we cheat just a little bit, we can benefit from both of those. How? We can still think of ourselves as honest and we can still cheat just a little bit. But under those conditions, we basically get to still think of ourselves as wonderful people.
Dan Ariely is a wonderful person. He teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. And I don't want to be audited this year.
No, of course not. Of course not. If you had a little too much to eat at Easter dinner or at Passover Seder last week, you could go to the gym to work off the extra pounds, or you could find a way to get both body and soul in shape. Faith-based fitness programs, apparently all the rage. The magazine Faith and Fitness says Southern Baptist churches alone operate more than 20,000 fitness centers nationwide. They don't do it without some financial controversy, though, as Tanya Ott reports from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama.
At first glance, the fitness center at Dawson Baptist Church in a suburb of Birmingham looks like any other recreation center. There are treadmills, an aerobics studio, even two basketball courts. On this night, Kenan Reed shoots hoops with his oldest son.
I like the church environment. I'm used to it. When I was younger, I played church league basketball, so it was a pretty easy decision to make to come here.
Reed says at $35 a month for his family of six, Dawson is a deal. But critics say it's not just a deal, it's a steal, because church fitness centers are tax exempt. They don't pay federal income taxes, they're built on land that's often exempt from property taxes, and in many states, churches don't pay sales tax on new fitness equipment. For-profit fitness centers, which don't get the tax breaks, say it's unfair competition.
If a church has a business, such as a fitness club with all kinds of services that are not related to their religious function, they're in competition with other similar businesses.
That's Ted Farnan, spokesman for the Missouri Department of Revenue. Last fall, Missouri started taxing yoga centers. Many of them protested, saying their practice has spiritual roots in Hinduism and Buddhism and should be tax exempt. But Farnan maintains there's a distinction.
I think it's important to note that when the department sent out the letters notifying people about this, we did not send these letters to Hindu temples or Buddhist temples. These were sent to businesses that were charging for their services and were not restricting it to people of a certain religion.
But back at Dawson Baptist Church, they don't restrict fitness center memberships to church members. Fitness director Nancy Legg says they accept people of all faiths and even no faith. Still, she says Dawson provides a service that's different from the for-profit gyms down the road.
Personal trainers are a cross between a therapist and a bartender. I can't give out drugs and I don't serve alcohol, but I hear lots of people's stuff. And I love the fact that right here where I am, I can stop and pray with somebody right on the spot. And that's exciting for me. I don't know that I could do that in other places.
Across the country, courts have ruled that some religious nonprofits are directly competing with commercial health clubs. Most notably, the YMCAs in some cities have lost all or part of their tax exemption because of their fitness centers. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by PBS, this week presenting the story of one man's journey to awakening, The Buddha, premiering Wednesday night at 8, 7 Central, only on PBS. By Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, exactly how big a financial hit Toyota is going to take from consumers because of its unintended acceleration problems is still up in the air. But we do have a better idea, though, of how much U.S. regulators are going to hit the company up for. The Transportation Department said today it's seeking the maximum possible penalty, more than almost $16.4 million. Secretary Ray LaHood said Toyota knew about the sticking gas pedals back in September, yet didn't issue a recall on it until January. Toyota has 2 weeks to appeal, should it so choose. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 46 points. That's about 0.4%. The NASDAQ added 26 points, more than 1%. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, almost 0.75% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune into the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, Chile's earthquake shakes a global industry.
When something happens there that disrupts their supply, all of a sudden people pay attention at lumber yards, construction sites, and paper mills in a lot of different places in the world.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.